Case number 19-5815, USA v. Christian Sherrill. Case number 19-5817, USA v. Eddie Poindexter. And case number 19-5983, USA v. Willie Somerville. Or arguments are cases 19-5815 and 19-5983, 10 minutes for each defendant, 20 minutes for plaintiff. Case number 19-5817 to be submitted on the brief. Mr. Alexander Conrad Wharton for appellant Willie Somerville.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, I'm attorney Alexander Wharton of the Wharton Law Firm in Memphis, Tennessee, on behalf of appellant Willie Somerville. On behalf of my client, I've previously requested minutes for rebuttal.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Simply put, and to get straight to the heart of the matter, this case involves a killing of a gentleman in Covington, Tennessee, which is in the Western District of Tennessee, a small town, a gentleman by the name of Timothy Edwards. My client and four others were charged with that killing. Simply put, outside of there being a killing at issue in this case, as we've addressed in the brief, is the government's prosecution and contention before the trial court and now before this court, that my client, along with the four others, attempted to engage in the robbery of Mr. Timothy Edwards, and the federal nexus, meaning the connection that gets this kind of case into the jurisdiction of a district court or any United States district court for that matter, is that this had or attempted to have an effect on interstate commerce. While the government argues and will probably argue today and argue before the jury and the court, it was clear and concise as to that issue. We submit that the briefs, as well as the record that the court has before it, was anything but clear and concise as to that essential component. Again, that is the nexus that allows any court of the United States District Court to hear this type of case, a Hobbs Act violation where there was an attempt to effect or an actual effect on interstate commerce.
Well, do you agree that under the Supreme Court's Taylor decision, that a robbery of drugs or drugs proceeds is enough to bring it within the Hobbs Act?
That is the law. Professionally, I have to respect the law. I may have personal disagreements or professional disagreements, but that is the law of the land.
You think that there was enough evidence, if that is the law, sufficient evidence to show that the robbery / killing that took place here was about drugs and drug proceeds?
I do not. And respectfully, I would point the court and Your Honor to the record from the trial proceedings. And as the government mentioned in its brief, there were actually two trials. One was ended in a hung jury or mistrial because of a absconded juror, but this matter was tried twice. And in the trial before this court and at issue before this court, if we look at the proof as to the federal nexus, the attempt to affect interstate commerce, the only evidence that the government had concerning a robbery was that two of the defendants who ultimately pled guilty and testified on behalf of the government testified that it was designed to hit a lick or commit a robbery. There was never, if I don't recall, and I reviewed the record again, there was very little, if any, proof that that robbery was intended to rob a person of drugs and or drug proceeds. If I and four or one other person or I by myself say I'm going to rob someone, that would normally not put this kind of case in the jurisdiction of the federal court. It has to be in an attempt to either affect interstate commerce through the robbery of drugs and or drug proceeds, as the Taylor case says. I think this case is distinguishable because there is no proof, unlike the Taylor case, and that involved, I think, a gang or mob of people who had committed a series of robberies on individuals, and they spelled it out, and they knew this was their MO. We're going to rob drug dealers. This particular case, we're talking about what some would describe as a haphazard agreement amongst five individuals to go and rob a person that started allegedly 2 weeks, as the record sets forth, in a jail cell unrelated to this incident. And at that point in time, in the government's own proof, I think there was a testimony of a gentleman by the name of Jabari Jarrett that implicated my client. And Mr. Jarrett, I believe, testified that, yeah, Willie Somerville said he was going to get at Timothy Edwards, of course, the victim, once he got out. There was no testimony from Mr. Jarrett that Mr. Somerville said he knew Mr. Edwards was a drug dealer, or he was going to go and rob him of drugs, or the intent was to rob him of drugs. So the nexus and the connection that the government sought to prove to the jury and now submits to this court, and which I believe was inappropriately rendered by not only the trial court, but the jury, of course, was that somehow with limited proof in the way of Mr. Edwards had $1,200 on his person, as well as a Travoy Middlebrook coming in and testifying at the second trial saying that, oh yeah, he knew Mr. Edwards had sold drugs, that somehow that testimony then somehow automatically transfers to the intent and the mens rea of those individuals who purportedly were involved, including my client, in the attempted robbery of Mr. Edwards. That is not enough. There has to be some nexus between those two. Additionally, at issue is the mens rea of each participant as an aider and abettor. Even if one or two participants had the intent to rob Mr. Edwards of drugs or drugs and or drug proceeds, the law is stated in the government's own brief and in our brief as well, sets forth. Not only do you have to agree to participate in some type of crime or see that it actually come about, participate in furtherance of that, but that crime has to be consistent amongst each person. The intent of each person has to be the same. That's the fundamental premise of an aider and abettor. So we set forth in our brief, not only is the issue of the interstate nexus and the jurisdictional requirement of the Hobbs Act has not been met for the trial court, but also the mens rea component of the aider and abettor statute that goes to that very count one, the Hobbs Act violation. Counts 2, 3, and 4 don't even get before the jury under case law and the statute if the government cannot prove, and which we submit that the evidence did not bear out, a conviction on count one. That is, again, the nexus and the ability for the jury and for this court, of course, to review the proof on counts 2, 3, and 4. Our second issue that we raised before the court is the severance issue. While the government's brief is correct in that it was never addressed again orally with the court once Mr. Poindexter's, Eddie Poindexter, which I believe the court has his appeal on brief, once his statement was thought to be introduced, there were separate, at least two oral motions for severance that were argued before the court and denied, one written motion. And the motion for severance was not simply on the basis of Mr. Poindexter's statement. It was more than just Mr. Poindexter's statement. And as the trial actually went forth, that we see that Mr. Poindexter's statement, although cured, and the government pointed that out, where I did admit that the court did its best to brutalize, if you want to use that as a term, the statement to properly redact it without it having any sufficiently identifiable information relative to Mr. Somerville. That statement alone was not the end of the spillover effect that affected Mr. Somerville's ability to cross-examine those individuals, as well as bear into the circumstances that led to Mr. Poindexter's statement. Because Mr. Poindexter, of course, has and exercised his Fifth Amendment right to not incriminate himself. It came out in the proof, the government's proof in the testimony of Agent Pugh, in which he sought to rehabilitate the credibility of two other co-defendants, Armani Hall and Daryl Owens, by introducing the full-blown statement of Eddie Poindexter. We believe that the court erroneously ruled that he was allowed to cure any statements or potential misstatements of those cooperating defendants and soon-to-be testifying defendants by the introduction of the full statement of Eddie Poindexter.
Your red light has been on for a while, so your time is up.
My apologies.
Okay. It's hard to
I did not see it. Right. I did not see it. My apologies. Thank you.
Save your time for rebuttal. That would be fine.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Your Honor.
Ms. Carriker?
May it please the court. My name is Vicki Carriker, and I represent Kristen Sherrill. At this time, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Sure.
Thank you. Similar to Mr. Somerville's argument, insufficiency of evidence for Mr. Sherrill was also a big issue in this case. The majority of evidence, as far as the aiding and abetting, when it applies to Mr. Sherrill, was quite limited in the proof that was put on by the government. In the jury instructions, it indicates that basically mere presence is not enough to make someone guilty of aiding and abetting of the Hobbs Act robbery. Essentially, the proof that was presented by the government in this case, by the co-defendants and the cooperating co-defendants, and essentially Mr. Poindexter's statement, was that Mr. Sherrill was there. He was in the vehicle, but never took active participation. He never recruited anybody. He never encouraged Mr. Somerville. And I think, and while it might be circumstantial in nature, that you can see the intent behind Mr. Sherrill's action when, as in the testimony of Mr. Owens, when they heard those gunshots, they basically fled the scene. A getaway driver drops off individuals to commit an act. They stay there and they help them escape and flee the scene. When the testimony at trial was when there were gunshots, that Mr. Sherrill and Mr. Owens fled the scene. People were running towards the car.
Did someone not be an aider or abettor if they simply drove people to the scene and then left?
Yes, Your Honor, that is possible. They can. But I think that they need to take a more active role than what happened with Mr. Sherrill's case. As the evidence pointed out, Mr. Somerville is a person of violence. It is a small town. One of the individuals that testified, Mr. Jarrett, indicated that basically my client, in some sense, was scared of Mr. Somerville. And while, once again, it is circumstantial in nature, it does go to the fact that he did not complete any of those acts when he fled the scene. He basically abandoned those individuals there.
And if you're arguing abandonment, the abandonment occurred after the shots were fired, right?
The abandonment did occur after the shots were fired. Yes, Your Honor, that's true. I just think when you look at the total nature of the jury instruction, the lack of basically something to help or encourage the crime, that you can actually be there as well and still not aid and abet. This was a situation where, you know, Mr. Somerville was heavily recruiting people, and there's just no evidence brought forth by the government that Mr. Sherrill was actively participating in that. We also raised the severance issue as well. And once again, the proof brought by the government specifically as to Mr. Sherrill was quite limited in many ways. In particular on the severance issue, and once again, just as Mr. Wharton said, we did not renew that objection when Mr. Poindexter's statement was put on, but we filed written pleadings. We had a full argument in front of the court, and they issued a written order on that. So I was at the time just abiding by the court's order by not renewing that objection. However, once again, Mr. Hall and Mr. Owens, who were co-defendants in this case, their comments about Mr. Sherrill and his involvement were fairly limited. And as we know from the proof, they gave several different statements, which we had the ability to cross-examine them on. Now, Mr. Poindexter's statement, while it was brutalized, was much more specific in people's roles. And we just feel that that was a violation of the Confrontation Clause issue, since we did not have the ability to cross-examine him and really get into that statement to make a determination of his credibility in this issue. One of the other issues that I brought up was there were numerous photographs that were introduced before the jury in this case. Not all of them involved my client. There was one specifically that involved my client where Mr. Somerville is wearing gang colors. And basically they're making gestures which were ended up being redacted that were presented to the court. But essentially, we made a 403 argument that that was unfairly prejudicial and should not be introduced. As we all know, any type of potential gang inference is always going to prejudice a jury on what was already a very serious case on a robbery and a homicide.
What was the photo introduced to show?
The photo was introduced to show that they had some type of connection, a nexus that they actually knew one another. And that was my real issue with this, which was Covington, Tennessee is an extremely small town. Many of the witnesses that got up and testified said they all knew each other. They had known each other for years. So my argument is that these photos were cumulative. And then to the fact that they ended up being overly prejudicial. There was really
prejudicial if the gang signals were redacted. Just the colors of the clothing?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the colors of the clothing, that particular gang, now my client actually was not in a gang, but in that particular gang, they wear blue. And while hand gestures were basically blacked out and blurred out, still, like, and maybe this is just from doing this too long, I don't know. I see a picture like the one that was introduced, and I see something which obviously looks to me like the posture, the way they're posed, that it appears that they're in a gang, and it's really only being introduced for that purpose only, considering the fact that there was absolutely no one objecting to the fact that these men knew one another. So those were
can I ask a quick question just to clarify? Are you making any argument that attempted aiding and abetting Hobbs Act robbery is not a crime of violence within the meaning of the second count, possession and furtherance of? Is that part of your sufficiency challenge, or do you concede in this case that it is?
I do concede on that issue, Your Honor. And if there's no other questions from the court, I'll submit.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I just want to be sure that Mr. Wharton is there. I don't see his photo. Is Mr. Wharton there?
I am, Your Honor. I was taking notes and I muted my video and my...
Okay. I just wanted to be sure that you were there, because when the government speaks, you want to be able to rebut it, and I didn't want you to be...
Sure. Yes, ma'am. Thank you. Sure. I'll just mute it. I'll mute it and keep my video on.
Okay,
thank you.
Great. Thank you. We can hear from Mr. Pritchard.
Good morning. This is David Pritchard for the United States. As Mr. Wharton indicated, this case is about the murder of a man named Timothy Edwards back in January of 2017. The proof was that Mr. Edwards was a small town drug dealer, and that the parties conducted a home invasion robbery in which Mr. Somerville shot and killed Mr. Edwards in the attempt to take drugs and drug proceeds from Mr. Edwards, which they believed would be at the house, to include cocaine, marijuana, and cash.
So what was the evidence, if we're getting to Mr. Wharton's argument, what was the evidence of the intent to rob Edwards of drugs or drug proceeds?
The proof of trial, Your Honor, was that Mr. Somerville, when he had gathered everyone together and they were in the car on the way over to Mr. Edwards' house, he started explaining what the roles of the parties would be and what the purpose was behind hitting a lick is what the phrase was that was used time and again in this case. But the testimony was that he believed that cocaine, marijuana, and cash, which would be drug proceeds, would be found in the house.
Is this testimony from the co-defendants Hall and Owen?
That's correct, John. And so that was the proof as to why they went there. The planning had been discussed and had been in place for a couple of weeks at least. Prior to that, when Mr. Somerville began talking while he and Mr. Sherrill were in custody about, again, that phrase, hitting a lick on Mr. Edwards. And then on the day of the murder, he began recruiting people. He and Mr. Sherrill went and knocked on Mr. Hall's door to get him. They picked up Mr. Owens. They went and got weapons and armed themselves and got Mr. Poindexter. At some point on the way over there, they switched places inside the vehicle. Mr. Sherrill became the driver of the vehicle. And as Mr. Somerville was assigning roles, they also designated a meetup spot where they would all meet to get in the car after the completion of the robbery. Prior to trial, as the court's aware, Mr. Sherrill and Mr. Somerville did file motions to sever. The government did redact the Poindexter statement that was made to law enforcement to remove the personal names of any of the other defendants. And we replaced those personal names with neutral words in compliance with Bruton and Richardson and Gray with words such as someone or others or we. As Mr. Wharton has acknowledged, he did ask for further redactions to the statement, which he said would cure the issue, which the district court appeared to understand would mean would resolve the issue and there would not be a severance complaint from Mr. Somerville any further. Poindexter had given a description of the vehicle that the parties were in that night on the way over to Mr. Edwards' house as a white Dodge Charger with the driver's side window broken out. And Mr. Somerville felt like that would be unduly prejudicial given other proof he anticipated being presented by the government. And so the district court ordered that further redaction. And so the statement that was presented to the jury contained those redactions in compliance with Bruton, but also the additional redactions that Mr. Somerville said would cure the issue. And then at trial, as the government sought to introduce the statement, the district court did ask if there were any objections. And Mr. Sherrill said no objections. And Mr. Somerville was silent on the issue. And so it's that background that leads the government to say that it's a plain error analysis that applies here because there was no contemporaneous objection at trial, preserving the objection that was raised pre-trial. Of course, we acknowledge the Sixth Circuit has not directly addressed this issue, and there is a circuit split on the issue of whether a pretrial motion to sever preserves the issue for appellate review. Whatever standard the court would choose to apply here in this case, the statement as redacted did not violate any confrontation clause issues. The Alden case out of this circuit from 2015, I would say, is instructive for the court in this matter. It's very similar factually in some ways. In that case, as well as this one, a group of individuals decided they wanted to hit licks, which in both cases meant robberies or attempted robberies of drug dealers of drugs and drug proceeds. And in the course of that activity, in both cases, a murder occurred. One of the defendants in Alden gave a statement to law enforcement in which he named his co-defendants. And the government in that case redacted the statement similarly as to the redactions in this case by substituting the personal names of any defendants mentioned with neutral words or phrases such as someone or the guys. And this court found that that was proper. It was not a confrontation violation. In this case, the government did the same thing. We replaced those personal names with neutral words. And then we went further and the district court ordered us to redact from the statement that went to the jury any description of the vehicle the parties were in that night. And so whatever standard the court chooses to apply here, there was no confrontation.
Was there or was there not a jury instruction, a limiting instruction, that the co-defendant's hearsay statement should only be admitted against, is it Poindexter?
Poindexter. There was not a limiting instruction, Your Honor. That issue was raised prior to the beginning of trial. The district court asked, you know, at any point if the parties wanted a limiting instruction on this issue as well as others. And neither Somerville nor Sherrill ever asked for a limiting instruction during the course of the trial or at the jury charge conference after the proof was in. And so there was not a limiting instruction by the district court.
I guess that's the theory for why Bruton is fine is that the hearsay statement is only being introduced against the co-defendant who made the statement. And without that limiting instruction, you could take the co-defendant's statement for the truth of the matter asserted for the other defendants. So it's almost like a more dramatic confrontation clause problem without the limiting instruction. But at the same time, I guess I could see strategically why defendants wouldn't want to highlight it. So I suppose there's no sua sponte duty on the district court's part to give this type of instruction to limit it to the person, the party admission who made the statement.
I think that's right, Your Honor. And that seemed to be the theory in another instance in the case where the district court told the jury to disregard certain testimony that came in. And at the jury charge conference, the topic came up, do the parties want a limiting instruction? And it seemed to be the concern that it would highlight the issue for the jury to have a limiting instruction. And so I think that theory is probably, it's fair to assume, was consistent with not asking for a limiting instruction as far as the Poindexter redacted statement that was introduced to the jury. As far as the sufficiency argument, of course, everybody knows that's a very demanding, exacting standard. You take the proof and the like most favorable to the government. It's not this court's role at this point in time, obviously, to try to resolve conflicts or make credibility. And basically, as Judge Murphy said in the Maya case, which I just happened to read yesterday, you accept the testimony of the government's witnesses as true at this point. I would make the argument that Mr. Wharton, in his brief, does not really challenge the conviction on counts 2, 3, and 4. And so we would say plain error applies as to those counts. He really only raises count 1 and talks about the interstate commerce clause issue. As was pointed out this morning, the Taylor case really seems to tell the court how to handle that. Even if it's intrastate robberies or attempted robberies of drug dealers, that does satisfy the commerce clause requirement. And the proof was in this case, not only that Mr. Edwards was a drug dealer, we had the testimony of someone who bought weekly from him, mostly at his home, and even up to a week before the murder, bought drugs from Mr. Edwards. There was also a local drug investigation that had been underway where a cooperating source had bought cocaine in small amounts from Mr. Edwards. So there was more than sufficient proof he was a drug dealer, and then there was more than sufficient proof that the intent of the parties that day was to rob Edwards in this home invasion of drugs and drug proceeds, the cocaine and the marijuana and the cash that they expected to be there.
So is it your view that there's no sufficiency challenge then to the second count? And the reason why I'm asking that is the same question as before, whether attempted Hobbs Act aiding and abetting is a crime of violence under 924C. Richardson, the case you cite in your brief, was only about aiding and abetting Hobbs Act robbery, not attempted aiding and abetting Hobbs Act robbery. The other circuits have said that attempted aiding and abetting Hobbs Act robbery is a crime of violence, but I'm not certain we have a precedent on point. Query, do we even need to reach that issue in your view in this case? Since I guess if nobody's challenging the sufficiency of the evidence on count 2, we would not have to.
That would be the government's position, Your Honor. It was not raised. It's not an issue presented by the parties. The Commerce Clause on count 1 was the only issue raised by Mr. Somerville, and Mr. Sherrill, who was convicted on counts 1 and 2, only raises mere presence alone is not sufficient. And I believe Ms. Carricker just conceded that she was not challenging whether attempted Hobbs Act robbery under an aiding and abetting theory is a crime of violence. So I don't think it's properly before the court at this stage. It's not raised by the parties.
But you concede that we don't have an actual case resolving that?
I did not come across one. There may be one out there. I didn't, to be honest, really research that issue because it was not raised in briefs of Mr. Somerville and Mr. Sherrill. So I can't say that I've fully invested a lot of time in looking at that really just trying to address what I thought was before the court. So there may be something out there that I'm not aware of, Your Honor, just to be candid. The proof, as far as the sufficiency is to counts one and two, the proof for Mr. Sherrill was a lot more than he was merely present, of course. We would say that his presence when they knocked on Mr. Armani Hall's door to recruit him was an encouragement to him, that it wasn't just Mr. Somerville trying to drag him into this, that Mr. Sherrill was there as well, and so that's encouragement. And, of course, as the district court and the jury found, Mr. Sherrill's role in this was as the getaway driver, which is a critical role in successful completion of a crime such as this. The law doesn't require him to be a good getaway driver, but that was clearly what the jury found to be his role. And so there was more than sufficient proof that he sought by his actions to encourage the successful completion of the home invasion of Mr. Edwards. As to Ms. Sherrill's point about the photograph itself was really fairly innocuous, particularly compared to photographs that are much more graphic, like the Cobb case that I mentioned, where the defendant was photographed engaged in a sex act, and that was introduced to corroborate the testimony of a witness at trial. Here, the government.
Why was the photo introduced?
Your Honor, it was introduced to corroborate the testimony of Armani Hall. His testimony was that the parties, for the most part, were childhood friends, except for Mr. Owens, that they had grown up together and they had associated with each other. And so this photograph, which was of Mr. Sherrill and Mr. Somerville together, corroborated the testimony of Mr. Hall. And the courts have found that's a permissible purpose. Of course, there was no stipulation by the parties that that these individuals, the defendants, knew each other. And so it was, it was not something that was resolved in front of the jury. Whether it was aggressively cross-examined or not is not really the issue. It was not stipulated to. And so the government was allowed to corroborate the testimony of Mr. Hall, who was aggressively cross-examined. It's obviously a very deferential abuse of discretion standard, and looked at in the light most favorable to the government, who sought to introduce the photograph. Given the broad discretion of the district court in such matters, there was no error. And even if there was some error that this court found, it would be harmless in light of all the other proof in the case. Those are really the only issues that were addressed by the parties this morning. I'm happy to answer any questions the court might have of me. Otherwise, I would just submit it.
Any questions from the other judges?
No, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Rebuttal from Mr. Wharton.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll get to the heart of the matter that Mr. Pritchard raised in terms of the intent of the parties or the knowledge of the parties prior to the robbery or attempted robbery of Mr. Edwards was clear. I don't think that the record bears that out. In fact, I believe the testimony of Mr. Owens, there was no discussion in the car whatsoever. While there may have been a discussion prior to parties getting in the car, if there is any proof, it's extremely limited as to the intent or what the purpose and the hopeful fruits of their labor would have been, whether it be drugs and or drug proceeds. As to the severance issue, the court has seen this and it's kind of a microcosm today in Ms. Carricker's argument on behalf of her client. And we raised this, that the severance issue was not simply Mr. Poindexter's statement alone. And while the circuit has indicated that antagonistic defenses are not necessarily unconstitutional and do not necessarily violate anyone's due process or trial rights and confrontation clause issues, when it becomes so voluminous as the record bears out, not only are you getting it from the defendants who are on trial with your client, but also those testifying, that's when it becomes, I believe, as the record bears out, unconstitutional and a violation of his ability to have a fair trial and the confrontation clause and things of the like. One issue that I did not get a chance to address was the sentencing issue. We briefed that and for the court's attention. If the court has any questions about that, I'm glad to address it. I think it on its face and the cases that we cited go to the heart of the sentencing issue, the sentencing being unduly unproportional to the
because you didn't talk about that in your main argument and the government doesn't have a chance to rebut. We'll rely on the briefs for that argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Other than that, I think the issue of the That red card comes up very quickly. Issue of the Hobbs Act is critical in this case, and I urge the court to dive into the record as to the lack of proof that creates the nexus for counts 2, 3, and 4.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Excuse me, Judge Moore. I'm sorry to interrupt. It appears we have lost Judge Murphy. I'm going to go back and bring him back in.
Okay. Thank you. Judge Murphy, are you there?
Yeah, sorry. Froze up on me.
It's amazing how things happen, isn't it?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have just finished with Mr. Wharton's rebuttal, and we will now have Ms. Carriker's rebuttal.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Just briefly to touch on a couple of issues. Once again, as far as the government's argument on the photo, I mean, it's true we did not enter any type of formal pleading or stipulation as to the parties knowing each other and their relationship. But once again, this was something that was litigated pre-trial. It was hotly litigated during the course of the trial. And one of the things we brought up to the judge and the government multiple times was, we're not planning on disputing this. We've never disputed it. We've never disputed the relationships. And frankly, the testimony of the other parties corroborates Mr. Hall's testimony. We just feel like those photographs were completely unnecessary to do that. And as far as the severance issue goes, I would just ask for this court to consider the fact that, I guess I should have said no further objections. Obviously, we objected to it since we litigated this pre-trial, but I would just ask this court to look at it substance over form when it comes to this issue. And I don't know why there was not a limiting instruction, and there potentially should have been. The other limiting instruction we were talking about was on some other issue. But confrontation clause is extremely important in matters such as this. And that's why we brought up this issue pre-trial and renewed it before the second trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your argument. The case will be submitted. The cases will be submitted.